Buddha asks Subhuti, when a stream enterer enters the stream, does he think to himself, I've entered the stream? Subhuti says what?
No.
Subhuti says no, he doesn't think that. Okay. So stream enterer, okay? Entering the stream happens at the same time as something else. What?
First perception of emptiness. First
What happens at the path of
sea? First direct perception.
Oh, direct! Ah, okay. You didn't say that before.
I said it, but not direct.
And they change your name to what?
Arya.
Those all happen at the same instant. So there's this big division in the universe. Okay? You could take how many planets? You talked about it last time, right? You could take a billion planets in this particular system with life on them, with human beings living on them. And you could take all those living beings and put them in one Star Trek ship or something. And you could divide them into two types. There's only two types of people in the whole universe. There's only two kinds of beings in the whole universe. This is the big division. It's not man, woman, animal, human, not human. It's not smart, dumb. It's not Buddhist and non-Buddhist. What is it? You're either an Arya or you're not. Okay? And that's the big, big division. In the whole universe, the first question a Buddha would ask somebody if he met him is, which side are you on? Okay, are you an Arya or are you not an Arya? It's a big distinction. When you see emptiness directly, you become a totally different class of person. You are in a totally different group. You belong with Bodhisattvas, Buddhas. You're in a totally different group of family, and you're totally different than what you were before the moment before that. Okay, that's called Arya. Is called Pakpa, and a non-Pakpa is called a Sosokyo. Okay, Sosokyo is just what it sounds like. What do you guess?
Sort of.
What we call we translate it as normal being. Okay, normal person. Sometimes they translate it as common person. Ordinary person. I think ordinary is good.
Yeah.
Ordinary person. There are a lot of ordinary people that aren't normal. Okay. So maybe ordinary is better. Okay? Sosokya, or Pratakjana in Sanskrit, or Arya or Pakpa in Tibetan. Huh? Pratakjana. Pratakjana. Anyway. An ordinary being. So you've either seen emptiness or you haven't. Directly. Sorry. And that puts you in a... Up until that moment, your career in samsara is unlimited. You can't say how long you'll stay here. Up until the moment you perceive emptiness directly, you're a sosokyo, you're a pratajñāna, you're a normal person, ordinary person. And if you ask somebody, well, how long I got to go in samsara, I say, as far as I can tell, it's limitless. You're going to suffer endlessly. I can't say how long it will take. I can't put a date or a limit on your experience of samsara. All beings will become enlightened someday. But if you ask me in your particular case, if you haven't seen emptiness directly, I can't answer that. It's way off in the future somewhere. No limit, no predictability much about it.
What about the Buddha? Don't you say the Buddha knows everything?
I'm talking Sosokya. Well, non-Buddha, okay. Pakpa, he's on his way out. He's definitely on his way out. Fixed time. He knows how long it's going to take. Typical is like 7 lives. But he is on his way out. It's like he stepped onto a conveyor belt and he's moving, what do you call it? Inexorably to nirvana and enlightenment. He must reach Buddhahood. He will reach Buddhahood in a certain amount of time. Period. Okay. That's the big difference. And that's why he's called a stream entering. That's exactly what stream entering means. He stepped on the conveyor belt, and he's moving inexorably downstream, and he will reach Buddhahood in a fixed amount, given amount of time. Yeah.
Also becomes a member of the Sangha at that moment as well, right?
We'll get there.
Michael, is stream entering just refer to somebody who is just directly,
we'll talk about that. All right. As Tom pointed out, a big thing happens at this moment. You become two of the three ratnas. When you're a Buddhist, what you pray to, you know, what you bow down to, is the three jewels, the three ratnas, the three gems. When you receive emptiness directly, you've already become one of them, and you have another one. So when all the Buddhists around the world are doing their morning prayers and praying, it's to you they're praying, because you become the Sangharatna. Sangha normally means ordained people, but ultimately it means anyone who's perceived emptiness directly is the real Sangha. Ordained people are called the nominal Sangha, but people who've seen emptiness directly are the real community. They're the real Sangha. And the Dharma Sangha, the Dharma Ratna, the jewel of the Dharma, is that perception of emptiness in your mind. Okay, that's a true path, it's a high path. You become the Dharma Ratna. You don't become the third Ratna, which is what? Buddha Ratna. You still got a ways to go. But you've already attained the status of two of the three precious jewels. When Buddhists around the world pray, go to their temples and pray, they're praying to you.
So one is the praying to you, and I'm sorry, what
you become two of the three ratnas. You become the Sangharatna. You become a member of the Sangharatna because you've seen emptiness directly, and that's what makes you real Sangha. This is just what we call representative Sangha. I represent, these robes represent those people, but they aren't, you can wear the robes and not be Sangharatna. And then Dharma Ratna. Dharma Ratna is that realization of emptiness in your mind, is the Dharma, is the real Dharma. Yeah.
So would you say that's the case only when you're in direct perception of emptiness, not when you're out of it?
Forever after. In the first second and forever after.
Even though you're not receiving emptiness.
Even though you're not doing it directly at the moment. Anyone who has had that path in becomes the Dharma Ratna. So that's a pretty big deal. And I thought we might talk about what it takes to get to that point. What are the prerequisites? How could people like you and me reach that point? What kind of process would you have to go through? The nice thing about the Tibetan tradition, which it comes purely from the Indian tradition, it's very, very specific. It's very, very laid out. It's lamrim. Tell you what to do, what you have to do, specifically what you have to do. And you just do it and you reach it. Prerequisites. Okay, we'll explain it. Nyan means definitely. Come out. Ultimately, it refers to nirvana and Buddhahood. Okay? Ultimately, it refers to coming out of samsara and coming out of lower nirvana. It means nirvana and Buddhahood. The ultimate nyanjum is nirvana and Buddhahood. That's the meaning of the word. The ultimate meaning of this word. To come out means to come out of your suffering and to come out of this kind of life and reach nirvana or Buddhahood. That's one meaning. The second meaning is totally different. The second meaning is very close to. Raptu means really. This is the same root, but it's a different spelling. It means left, gone away. Raptu Chuma means to leave the home life. Okay? The classical meaning of Raptu Chuma is to leave the home life. Before you become a full monk, or before you become a novice monk, when you decide to leave the home and come to live in the monastery, you have to take a Raptu Chuma vow. It's before the other vows. It's a vow that says, I agree to leave the home life. I will leave the home life. I will come and stay in the monastery. Mm-hmm. It's a requirement to become a novice or a full monk. Left, really left the worldly life.
Does that mean physically?
We'll talk about it.
Okay,
it's coming. Okay. So the second meaning of Nyenju is to leave the worldly life. Is to leave behind the worldly life. So Nyenju is the Tibetan word for the first of the three principal paths.
It's renunciation.
Is true renunciation related to any one of the five paths? It is reaching the first path, okay? Reaching the first path and gaining true renunciation are the synonyms. You can't reach the first path without renunciation. When you do reach the first path, it is by getting renunciation. And that's another meaning of Nyenju. So Nyenju means, in a sense, Raptachuang, which means to leave the worldly life. And this is the relationship between the first and the third path, okay? To see emptiness directly, to see that thing directly, you will have to leave the worldly life. Okay? You'll have to leave the life of career or family or kids or husband or you will have to. If you don't, you can't get to this thing, you never will.
Why is that?
You won't have the mental or physical time. Your mind will be devoted to the worldly side of things instead of the spiritual side. And your time physically will be to maintain the worldly life. It takes time. It takes too much of your time. You just can't do it. You won't be able to do it. Does it mean you have to quit your job and divorce your wife? The Buddha did. No, it doesn't mean you have to. Okay? I mean, Nyenju is a mental state. And many monks in the monastery, it's said in the scriptures, have never even approached Nyenju, renunciation. And many great laymen like Dzogchen Jay or Naropa, people like that, never became monks. But mentally, they left the home. They left the worldly life. They left the home life. What I mean is, as long as a good part of your mind is given over to your career or your family life, you won't have mental or physical time. You won't reach the third path. It's just an insurmountable obstacle. And you have to make a choice in your life. The worldly efforts are useless. They're meaningless. There's no result. You just die and get old. You lose whatever you were fighting to collect, whether it was a house or cars or family or a position at your company. You lose them all. It's a wasted effort. It doesn't mean you shouldn't work. It doesn't mean that if it comes to you in a good way, you can't be president of a big company. But it means you shouldn't give your mind to that. Or you just can't. You'll never reach the third path. Yeah.
Isn't it kind of like no longer defining yourself by these situations and so forth? I mean, you could be in them, but so long as you mentally just really don't define yourself by as being connected
to like
this person's son or this person's husband or this person's boss or whatever.
It's just very dangerous. If you're an extremely strong person spiritually, perhaps you could brush with those things and still survive spiritually and not die spiritually. It's very dangerous. It's a very dangerous game. Okay. You get sucked into it. It's very hard to have a big position. It's very hard to have a big family. It's very hard to own a lot of things and not get somehow sidetracked spiritually. Very difficult. It can be done. And it's an art to do it, but be careful. And I'm just talking as a friend, you know. I have a job also, I have commitments to people also, but between us, the less the better, and you really have to devote yourself to the spiritual side if you want to see emptiness directly. The other side is death. The other side you lose. There's no meaningful result of that activity. It's doomed. And I can't change that, you know. For me to be honest to you and to really say what really is required, you have to give that up. Most of it, maybe even really physically give it up. Part of it, you have to have a livelihood. That's also Buddhism says that. You have to have an honest livelihood and don't grub off other people. It's very clear. And you can't abandon your commitments to your family and things like that. It's not proper. But you mentally, you have to leave the world. You might as well leave it now. You're going to leave it later anyway. Between now and then, you might get some spirit. You might reach third path. Otherwise, it's just a wasted opportunity, and who knows when it will come again. Maybe it won't come again for many lives. This life is very finite. Your energy is lost quickly. You know, you could have a heart attack or get sick any day. That would be the end. You do have to give it up. You really do have to give it up. Yeah.
We said in the last class that the perfection of patience was the highest austerity.
Yeah.
So if you, and better than being in a cave for 5 years.
Yeah.
So then wouldn't you want to stay in some form of the worldly life in order to have a practice that you were tested in?
Well, I think if your career is truly symbolic, if the only reason you're working is as a laboratory, I truly believe that, like an office environment, is tremendous for spiritual practice. But you're flirting with danger. It's very, very dangerous, and that all that stuff. Ultimately, you have to give it up. You have to. You won't have mental or time. You're too much in your mind will be devoted to it, and your time, your physical time, your short, useful, healthy middle age will end soon. And then all of those other things that you worked for, they go away anyway. You must lose them. Everyone loses them. I'm just being honest. I've never spoken to you quite like that. But you have to do that, or you won't see it. You won't see it. Okay? Second thing.
Michael, I'm sorry, you lost me. Are these Nenjun and Reptu Junwa, are they two parts, or one is a subset of the other?
Reptu Junwa describes the second meaning of Nenjun. The first meaning of Nenjun is nirvana itself, which means to come out of suffering.
Mm-hmm.
The second meaning of Nenjun is renunciation, which I'm equating with the Reptu Junwa, which means leave the home life. If you can physically, if you can't, then mentally. And physically as far as you can. Number two?
Okay.
Requirement number two.
To reach Buddha?
See emptiness there.
Michael,
so
renunciation is the second meaning?
No, it's the first.
Renunciation is the second meaning of the second meaning of the word Nyantin, which refers to the first path. Say Jolam.
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 That's requirement number two. The second path, if you don't reach it, you'll never see emptiness directly. Impossible. That's why there's five paths. That's why the Buddha taught it.
What is it?
Jolam. Jor means preparation. Lam means path. What happens on the second path?
Gain intellectual familiarity.
Intellectual realizations of emptiness. Okay? Not direct, but it's from study, from contemplation, from a lot of class hours, you start to grasp emptiness in an intellectual way, not in a direct experience meditational way. And there's one concept which defines Jorlam. If you understand this concept, you will reach Jorlam. It's a very difficult content. It's a big, big subject in the monastery. We start learning it. A monk in the monastery starts getting it when he's about 13. is starting on that. And maybe much later it flowers in his mind. Okay. It's not what you might expect. Second path before what? Direct That's the whole idea tonight. See what? How do you get there?
So the first path is the path of accumulation.
Yeah, and you can call it renunciation. You can call it leaving the world in line, and which you must do. Say chi,
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 chi, chi,
chi. It's difficult, okay? Chi means some people translate this by translating it literally. It's helpful, but it's not the main meaning. It's very difficult. And you'll see, but I'll explain it and you'll catch it, and maybe tomorrow you'll see emptiness. Directly.
Michael, are you saying that all of these, this breakdown is the translation that's literal but not...
What I'm saying is, when you achieve the path of preparation, you will understand that these words refer to these two things, quality and characteristic. Most Western scholars in books translate them this way, which is helpful, but it's not the real meaning. The idea of a chi is very, you have to know it. There's four types of chis. I'm going to tell you the least important one first. You don't have to write the Tibetan. You can, maybe the sounds will be useful for you. But it's going to be a wild class, but we gotta move, okay? Say Tokchi.
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 Tok means what? You just had a Tok, right? Collection. It means collection. Chi means general, quality. This refers to a whole composed of parts. A whole composed of parts. An example would be a human body. Okay, what are the parts?
Arms,
legs, torso. Okay, arms, legs, torso, and head. Those are parts. All that together is called the Tsokchi. It's called the whole. That's one kind of chi. That's one kind of chi. And what's the example?
Cards.
You can say cards. I'm saving cards for something else.
Body.
Okay. I want to keep it consistent. Body and its parts. Okay? Two arms, two legs, torso, and a head. And the Tsokchi is all those parts together. It's called the human body. Now we're getting into the really important one. That one's not so important, okay? The second one is very important. Say, Rikchi.
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 That means quality. That one means quality. An example is, and the thing which is characteristic of car is Chevrolet. Okay? Chevrolet is one kind of car. Anytime you have a Chevrolet, you have a car. Anytime you have a car, you have a...
No. You have a car.
By the way, everything in the universe can be a Rikchi, but that's another subject. You don't necessarily have a Chevrolet, right? That's the nature of a characteristic. There are many objects which share the quality car. There's Fords, there's Toyotas, there's Nissan.
But chi means body, but he...
No. Chi means quality or general. And Rik means type, kind. Chevrolet is a kind of car. Car is a Rikchi. Chevrolet is the Chedak. It's characteristic. It has the characteristic car. The question is this. When you go out on the street and you see a taxi cab bearing down on you, okay? And when you see a taxi cab, how do you know it's a taxi?
Yeah.
Huh? Oh, when I look at Banyan, how do I know he's a person? What is it that makes me recognize him as a person? What makes me identify him as a person? If it's just his characteristics, then anyone would recognize him as a person.
No projection.
It's very, very difficult, okay? The non-Buddhist schools believe that there's a separate entity called Bunyan's identity, and it cloaks him like a coat. And when I look at him, I understand that he's a man or a human being. because that thing is recognized by some part of my mind that I'm not even aware of. Okay? Meaning something that's not correct.
So you say certain general characteristics, if you have the karma to perceive those characteristics as...
Not getting into that really, but how is it that when I look at him, what happens that I recognize him as a human being? He's a particular human being. He's one kind of human being. His humanness is a general quality of him. He's typical of humans. But what is it about, why, when I look at him, do I think human? Because I'm focusing on Banyan. Why do I think human? What is it about him that allows me to identify him as a human? This is a real big question in Buddhist philosophy. And the Dharmakirti, we've debated for months and months. When you look at the parts of a cow, what is it that allows you to recognize cow, human?
Is this the preconceived idea?
It's a collection of parts that is unique to one particular kind of a collection. And that collection we distinguish as a human collection.
We distinguish, but why? How?
Is it your karma?
Because there are no other collections like it.
It's a convention.
Your projection, your karma.
Think about it, cook it, okay? It's very, very important. And it's, don't just give the answer that you heard in class. You know, go home, you're going to have to meditate about this. It's a deep question. It's very important for perceiving emptiness. Why is it that I see humans? Why is it that I identify him? That's his chi.
Memory,
isn't it?
I mean, it's memory. You thought. Prior conception. Is it a
human being? A cow. No. Two kinds.
Cows.
So could you exclusive of Carr and Chevrolet, could you use other words to describe this, Richie?
General and characteristic. This is the true chi. This chi is similar, but it's obviously not the same, right?
Yeah.
Your leg is not you, yeah. But a Chevrolet is a car. Big difference. They are both kinds of generals. Whole is a general for the parts, but set and subset, cars and Chevrolets, it's a whole different kind of relationship.
So you would say set and subset is an accurate way.
I don't think about quality and characteristic. There's something important there. Okay. Say, Junchi. Junchi. A chi here is a mental picture you get when I mention something that you've seen before. If I say, what does Rusty look like? Okay, what does the white dog over there look like? Who just barked? Okay. What does he look like? If I say Rusty's barking, you, when I say Rusty, something pops into your mind. Maybe it's the dog that bit you. Most people. That's a dunchi. Okay? That's a dunchi. It's a mental image of something that you have experienced directly. Dun means actual object. Okay? Dun means the actual object. Chi means a mental picture you get of that actual object. When I say, what does Rusty look like? And this, you know, fuzzy white thing pops up in your mind, that's a dunchi.
Well, can you say, I mean, generally what enables you to do this is your ability to conceptualize.
You have to cook it, okay?
A lot of cooking.
What is the dun?
Dun means the actual object. Chi means a mental picture. In this case, it means a generalization, an idealization in your mind.
Is this only visual?
No. Any object. I could say love. And you get a dunchi, if you've ever felt it, directly. Okay. Say, da.
Da.
Chi.
Chi.
Da-chi.
Da-chi.
Da means a word. Da means a word here. It means sound. Here it means word. Chi means what?
A mental image.
In this case, a mental image. A general in sense of this, in the sense of an idealization in your mind. Dachi refers to, if I say, that's a good example. Anybody ever been to the Taj Mahal?
Yeah.
I know, you have. Okay, suppose you've never been to the Taj Mahal, and I say Taj Mahal. You get some kind of mental image. You know, I say, when I said, have you ever been to the Taj Mahal? you checked your mental image. You had a mental image of this thing, and then you checked it against your memory, and you said, nah, I've never been there. I heard about it. Heard about it is done. The chi you get in your mind from hearing about it is a dachi. And it implies that you've never seen this thing directly.
So if you had seen it, it would be a
dachi? Yeah, it would be a dachi for you. For those of you who have seen the Taj Mahal, and I say Taj Mahal, and you get a dachi in your mind. But those of you who've never seen, I've never seen the Eiffel Tower, okay? When you say Eiffel Tower, even though I've seen pictures, movies, drawings, but I don't have a dachi. I've never experienced it directly myself. That would be, for me, a dachi. Taj Mahal is a dachi for me. I've never seen the Taj Mahal.
So a dachi is a mental image based on a direct perception, and a dachi...
A direct experience of that thing. It could be a logical perception.
Well, a dachi could be logical as well, if someone's explained it to you, right? I mean, that's how you get a logical perception of avoidance.
Dachi doesn't involve a process of reasoning. It's just that someone's described it to you and you have a picture of it. That's all.
So it's an image based on anything but an experience.
You can say that.
Is dachi the checking process or the conclusion?
It's not checking or anything. You've heard about the Taj Mahal.
Yeah.
Somebody says there's this big building in India. It's all white.
Yeah.
And you start to form a mental image. That's all. That's a dachi.
That's not, for example, what you have about seeing the picture.
No. You do have a dachi about a picture of the Taj Mahal. Okay. You have had a direct experience with your eyeballs of a picture of the Taj Mahal. But the Taj Mahal itself for you is just something that someone described to you through pictures in your...
So it's not even you doing the picture in your head?
It is doing the picture in your head, based on the words of somebody, or indirect experience.
Is it like visualization?
Well, if you've ever seen Tara, and you visualize her, that's a dachi. If you've never met her, that's a dachi.
Okay.
Something is, there's a point in your spiritual career, if you ever get to that, because you got to get over which mountain first? The world in life, okay? If you ever get over the first mountain in this life, okay? If in this life you ever truly leave the world, if you ever truly, while you're still healthy enough to do it, give up on this world, then you've got another mountain to get over. And that's the path of preparation. And you must grasp what's going on with chi. Okay? And what's going on is, every object you experience, let's say visually, okay, when you're making a cup of tea and you see a pot on the stove, there is no pot out there. There is no pot out there. You see some roundness. You see some white reflection from the silver in the back. You see part of the black handle. You never see the whole pot. But your mind takes those clues, tastes them together, and idealizes it into a thing called pot. And when you think you're seeing pot, and when you interact with the pot, and when you make a pot of tea, all you're ever seeing is what?
It's
that idealization. It's that mental picture. And you are constantly mistaking it for a pot out there. Now you understand that intellectually. I'll say it again. When you look at a pot, and you think to yourself, pot, when you look at banyan, and you think, human being, it's never because you've perceived a whole, perfect human being out there. It's because you've taken some of the indications. I can't see the back of him. For all I know, he's Terminator 3. Okay? he's got a big key in the back. But on the clues I have, and by the way, I can never have more than a few at a time. I take one from there, then my eye goes dick, 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 dick. I take the hand, I take the pen in the hand, I take the sitting up, I take the head, and I glue it all together mentally, and in my mind I have a nice, perfect banyan, human being. I think, person. I think to myself, person. But actually, what I'm focusing on is that mental Junchi. Okay? I'm focusing on that mental picture. There isn't that thing out there. I'm taking those clues and I'm visualizing, finding in my mind, and I'm thinking person. And I'm always mistaking that mental image for the real thing out there. For a quote real thing out there. I'm always doing that. Do you understand that intellectually?
Yep.
Yep. How you connect them depends on you. She asked for it.
To be, to see my.
I'm going to explain it right now.
To see.
Chen means what? Oh, please.
Dharma.
Dharma, okay.
Dharma.
No. We'll get there, don't worry. No. Chichau means supreme Dharma. Chichau means supreme Dharma. It is the final stage of the second path. There are four major stages in the second path, and Chichok consists of the last few hours of the second path. It's called Chichok because it's the highest state you will ever be in as a
suffering.
As an ordinary being. Because right after that, what happens?
You see
the emptiness directly. Okay. Chochok's name is not the Supreme Dharma, right? What is the Supreme Dharma?
Buddhahood.
But as an ordinary being, as a non-Arya, as a non-realized person, and I use realized not as enlightened, okay? Realized meaning someone who's realized emptiness directly. This is the big moment of your life. It's the highest level you'll ever get to as a non-Arya, before you perceive emptiness directly. This is your day. It's the final hours of the path of preparation. You got over the first mountain, which was what? Leaving this world. You got up very high on the second mountain because you started to study generals and characteristics. You got higher and higher and higher, and you're just about to reach the peak. That's Chichau. When you get over that peak, it's the big valley of seeing emptiness directly, okay? You reach the golden land, okay? It's at this moment, in the last hours of the path of preparation, that you figure out what you're doing with those dunchis. It's at that moment, for the first time ever, that you perceive directly, clearly, perfectly, that there is no bunyan out there, and that you are looking at a mental picture of him that you've pasted together from some indications. In fact, you have just then understood perfectly the nature of what?
Emptiness.
What? It's not emptiness. That comes in.
Self-realizing?
Dependent origination itself.
Okay.
This is dependent. This is relative truth. You have lived in relative truth for beginningless time. You've been in relative reality since beginningless time. You have lived many trillions of lives surrounded by these objects, and you have never once understood what they were. You've never understood their dependent origination. At this moment, in the last stages of the path of preparation, you catch yourself doing it. You realize what it is to be projecting. For the first time, you realize it directly. You can understand it intellectually all this time. Yet at Chocho, at the final moments, you finally catch yourself creating relative truth, dependent origination. You finally figure out what you've been doing all this time. For the first time. It's a big moment. Really, you have just perceived deceptive reality for what it is for the first time, directly. You understand it tonight because I'm describing it generally and you're understanding it generally. At that moment, you see there's no pot on the stove. You see directly that it's all part of your mental idealization. You see that directly. You have just perceived the truth of deceptive truth, of deceptive reality. You've just perceived what it is to be dependently originated for the first time. Then you go, yeah.
Is that like seeing emptiness directly? That will only happen once?
Yeah, chuchok only happens once. Then you go into deep meditation. And your mind must leave this realm. Your mind must reach a level of concentration called the form realm. In fact, it's a certain level of the form realm and a certain stage within that level. It's called Nichome, which you don't worry about. So that brings us, that implies another prerequisite. What?
Concentration.
Yeah, just to be in the right frame of mind to perceive emptiness directly. Just to have that foundation to stand on, to stand up and see emptiness directly. Just to ever be in the state of concentration required to see emptiness directly, your mind has to actually leave this realm. Your body doesn't go anywhere. Your body's in meditation posture. You learned it. Your mind actually, you get a physical sensation of the mind going up to the form realm. Your mind is on a different level, totally different level. Now, something about the prerequisite part. You cannot ever reach that state if you don't meditate about an hour a day. It's totally, completely impossible. So if you don't want to see emptiness directly, and you enjoy this suffering,
no.
Skip your meditations regularly.
Watch TV.
And don't write them on your homework. Okay? Yeah.
Could that be considered perfect concentration yet? For at least a moment or so?
It is shining. Yeah. It is shining. It's shamatha. You must have shamatha. You cannot reach it unless you spend an hour a day in deep meditation.
Okay.
Cannot. Not straight. Somebody asked me that in another class. It doesn't have to be straight. But if you're not, she means unbroken concentration for a whole hour. No, you don't need that. But if you're not practicing it specifically for about an hour a day, getting into deep meditation on any virtuous object, doesn't matter. You cannot reach the tapestry. You never will. You will always suffer. You will die in some hospital or in some old folks' home, and it'll be over. Okay? You have to be fairly young and healthy to reach there. So we're reaching the threshold of where it would be very difficult for us to do it. If you're my age. Okay? Too young. Still was a little younger than you. Kalibak only 18. You just can't reach it. You never will. So for God's sake, start now. Okay, please. You have to. You really have to. Please start now. Okay? You must. It's very convenient. You have an assignment every week. If you get this class tonight and you don't do anything, the second time you hear it, you won't do anything either. Guaranteed. Okay? Seriously, that's the nature of... Sometimes I regret teaching so much because the second time you hear it, you think I already heard that. It doesn't affect you. In Tibetan, it's called chepto. It's a spiritual phenomenon which happens to all students. The more you hear it, the less you are likely to change. If you don't change in the first few times of hearing something, the odds later are almost none. You must do it now. You must start now. If you don't start, you cannot see emptiness directly. So we have three prerequisites already. They're kind of difficult. You have to leave the world. You must explore the meaning of general and characteristics. And you must be meditating about an hour a day in deep meditation. You can meditate, as Sakyas, the great holy Sakya masters have said, 7 minutes on, a few minutes off, 7 minutes on, a few minutes, that's okay. But deep, deep, pure, nice meditation. And you have to understand those things about mental pictures. You must understand what you're doing when you look at Banyan and you see this perfect Banyan in your mind. You think he's out there, right? You think he's sitting next to you. You wouldn't say he's inside your capacity to put your mind in that state, because if you can't, you'll never see emptiness. It's impossible. Directly. Impossible. A mind in a normal working... if your mind is in the desire realm, which means it's the realm of the five senses, it's impossible to see emptiness directly. Cannot ever happen. Will not ever happen. Yeah.
So these four types of qualities that you broke down for us, would you, is this another way of saying, is there four ways of looking at emptiness, four ways of describing
it? No, not at all. Because four ways of looking at mental images. I gave you three prerequisites for seeing emptiness correctly. You must give up the worldly eye. You must understand mental images, what you're doing with mental images, how you mistake them for real things. And then thirdly, you must practice deep state of meditation on any virtuous object you choose. Doesn't matter. You had a question for me.
Why is it an hour?
I'm just telling you it's an hour, okay? It really is.
At least 1 hour.
Minimum. Die next week and you got 7 days to see emptiness directly. And if you do see it, you will forever after have pleasant lives. And you will be a Buddha within 7 lives. I mean, you would get your ass to your meditation room and start working, right? And you might even do it. Say, Chula.
Chula.
Chushapa.
Chushapa.
Chula.
Chula.
Chushapa.
Chushapa.
Chu means what? Do you guys know? Water. La means in. Chu means what?
Water poured into the water.
Pouring water into the water. Now you have to listen very carefully, okay?
Mm-hmm.
You have that experience at Chicho. You go to the kitchen to make a cup of tea. You're making a cup of tea for number six. And you're standing in that kitchen in Sistu, in Hall, New Jersey. You look down at the stove. You look at the pot. You've been studying Chicho Dap intensely. You've been meditating at least an hour a day. You've already left the world a long time ago. You're looking at the pot, and suddenly you realize that there's no pot out there. And that it's an idealization that you're making up by seeing certain parts of the pot. You perceive relative truth. You know what you're doing now. You know that you've been doing that all along and that there never was anything out there. That's not emptiness. You go to the temple, you sit down, your mind goes up to the form realm, it's a physical sensation, and then you see emptiness directly. Okay? What is it like? It's indescribable. No person can describe it to you. And there's something very important. While you're perceiving emptiness directly, you cannot have any other thought, because that would not be ultimate reality. That is a relative reality. So what can't you think while you're seeing emptiness directly?
You
can't be aware that you're seeing it. You can't say to yourself, my God, finally, here's the big moment. You can't even think, and it's a very, very important basic thing. You cannot frame the thought, I'm seeing emptiness. You can't do it.
You're not stumbling.
Not
from
now.
Within.
Not now. Okay?
You're talking about not being self-aware.
No other experience but pure emptiness. You cannot describe it in words. Not something you can describe. It's called Chula Chushapa. It's called like pouring water into water.
What's the water going into what water?
Pure, clear, crystal water being poured into pure crystal water. That refers to the subject and the object at that time. It refers to you and emptiness. And it's called Senina.
Nyupa.
Nyupa. Ni means two. Two things. Nang means appearing. Nang means appearing. Nyupa means disappears. Nyupa means disappears. What it means is the appearance of two things disappears. You and what you're seeing. Okay? The awareness of you and the emptiness that you are seeing directly at that moment, that whole awareness disappears. That's what Western scholars translate as non-duality. Non-duality is a very, very dangerous word. I don't believe it's understood by 90% of the people who hear that word. and it's on your homework, okay? Non-duality does not mean that you and the object are somehow one. Okay? It does not mean that you melt into the object. You are a positive, changing thing. Emptiness is a negative, unchanging thing. You cannot melt into that object. Your natures are totally, completely opposite, different. It doesn't mean that. Chula Chushaka, pouring water into water, has nothing to do with you somehow becoming that object, or you somehow intermixing with that object, or your essence being that, and you going home to your essence, or some crap like that.
It doesn't mean that.
Really, it's a dangerous, stupid idea. There's two true meanings of this. The first one I already said, which is what? You just can't be aware of subject and object. Okay? They don't go away. It's not that they don't exist. Because the subject, in this case, is a relative object, you just can't be aware of it at that moment. You can't perceive your hair or your ears or your breathing or the taste in your mouth. You just can't. You're focused on a different type of reality. You don't live in that reality, okay? You can't see anything else. You can't see anything from your old reality of doing cheese. Because you're perceiving pure reality, ultimate reality, which is a much higher reality. Okay? You can't. That's the first meaning of non-duality, if you want to use the word. Second meaning is nyamni.
So would you say you're not perceiving the duality because you're not perceiving
because
you're not perceiving any difference in anything.
Right.
Perceiving anything, period.
Perceiving any relative truth on it. Say nyamni.
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 Get the tongue twister, okay? Nyamni.
Nyamni.
Nyam means equal. Nyamni means totally equal. The second meaning of non-duality, if you want to use that word. Okay. What was the first meaning?
You can't be aware of a subject.
You can't be aware of a division between subject and object. It does not mean that the division doesn't exist. You just can't be aware of it. Second meaning is, yeah, you and the object are one. You and the object are one, but only in a one sense. What's that sense?
In the sense that you're perceiving in your mind. Or no.
In what way are you equal to every other object?
Empty.
In your emptiness. Okay. Every object in the universe has its own emptiness. So you are totally equal to all other things in the universe in that you are both what?
Empty.
Empty. Your emptiness is one quality that you share. Emptiness is a quality that you share with every other object in the universe. In that sense, non-duality. Okay. So we got three different things here. Non-duality doesn't mean what?
You merge.
You merge into the object. You are the object. Your essence is the essence, and you go back to the big hole in the sky where you came from, and all those other bullshit books, okay? Number two. What is it? The first meaning that's correct is what? You just can't see subject and object at that moment because that's relative and object, and your mind is focused on a totally higher reality where those things don't exist. So you can't be aware of it. Doesn't mean it went away or anything like that. Third meaning is what? You and the object are equal, totally equal in one sense only. You're both empty. Because that always was that way.
But there are different emptinesses. You know, you have your emptiness.
You can define each emptiness by the object which has it. And only that way. The quality of the emptiness is perfectly equal. Totally equal. Your emptiness and mine's emptiness are totally equal. Mine's attached to a different basis. Mm-hmm. And yours is attached to a different basis. But the nature of those two emptiness is totally, purely equal. Like diamond bits. That's all I'm going to say about the actual experience of emptiness directly, because you can't say much more than that. It goes on for a few minutes. It goes on for 5 minutes at most. Much shorter time. You're not aware of the passage of time, but I mean, when you come out, you look at the clock, and it's 3, 4, 5 minutes gone. It's very short. It is the essence of all the books you ever read in your life about Buddhism.
That's scary.
Okay. That's scary. holiness, no?
So when do you see the truth in lives?
Yeah. We're going to talk about that. But what I mean is, you realize as you come out, and we'll talk about what happens when you come out. But that experience is the essence of all Buddhist literature. And that's why Nagarjuna called it a puddle. So if you walk over that puddle, you wash over all the oceans of the world. Okay? There's nothing in the books on Buddhism that you don't clearly know from that few minutes. Very common to that year. What's it mean?
Wisdom.
We're going to go a little late tonight. Just forget about it, okay? We have to finish this. And I'll make it up to you some other day. That's what you say in the diamond business. When you're underpaying somebody. Okay? Wisdom that you get afterwards. You see emptiness directly. It only goes on for a few minutes. And then you have a sensation of your mind coming down out of the formal. Okay, you actually have a sensation of descending from the formal. If you saw emptiness directly in mid-morning, the Jeto Vyeshi goes on for the rest of the day until you sleep, until late at night. All day long, for the rest of that day, you are having incredible realizations. That's called Jeto Vyeshi. That's part two of the path of seeing. I haven't talked to you much about that. There's two parts of the path of seeing. Not all the period in the path of seeing is spent seeing emptiness directly. There's this other period, it goes on till the end of that day, that you have all these incredible understandings, all these incredible kinds of knowledge. Go on the whole rest of the day. They start while you're actually still in your meditation posture. They go on the whole rest of the day while you're walking around and in other activities during that day. Mm-hmm. I'm going to give you a few examples, okay? I can't cover all of them. I can't cover everything that you understand that day.
If you're going to be here all night, you might as well be warm.
Okay, truth of suffering. I left out a word. What is that? Noble Arya. Okay? The real translation is Arya. Noble is a mistake made by an early British translator.
They like that word.
Arya truth is something. Why called Arya? Arya see. Okay? Do they see the truth of suffering while they're perceiving emptiness directly?
No.
Cannot. It happens afterwards. I'll give you two examples of each truth. Okay? As you come out, you see directly your death. You understand that death is real for the first time in your life. You clearly, directly understand your death. Until that time, you really don't. You really directly understand how inevitable it is that you will die. Number two, for that day, you can read other people's minds directly. You can see what other people are thinking. Directly, okay? You can go to a store. Let's say that you saw emptiness directly and you decided that you had to buy a diamond and the only money you had was a car that someone had given you. You would go and sell the car and walk home and you would tell the guy, I'll sell you this car for anything. I don't care, give me anything. And the guy is quite pleased because he really understands that he found someone who's going to sell him a car for half of what it's worth or 10. And he offers you $200 for a $2,000 car. And you know it's enough to buy a diamond, so you say, okay. And all the time he's thinking how he's cheating you. And he's talking about something, you know, hey, you look like a nice guy, what are you doing, you know, where do you work, you know, blah, blah, blah. And you can read his mind, and you know he's thinking about cheating you. And you see the mental afflictions in his mind, directly. And you don't say anything to him, but you can read his mind for that time. That's an example of the truth of suffering. You see the suffering in his mind, directly. You know exactly what he's thinking. You hear and know what he's thinking. No.
Michael, on death, do you mean you actually see the death process?
No. You know your death. Something like that experience. You understand that you have never had a correct perception in your whole life. Not in any of the moments of consciousness that you've had in all of those lives. And specifically in your most recent life, you've never had a correct perception. Never, ever seen anything correct.
What about the same as that was supposed
to be having all the time? No. Not in talking to you. No. We'll talk about it. You realize that no person you've ever had in this life. It's related to that general thing.
Excuse me, Michael?
Later. Don't interrupt, please. You see the truth of utility. Utility means this. You see it's true that you've never undertaken an action in your life that wasn't meant to benefit you directly. For your own use. Any relationships you have, anytime you did any good deed, it was all pretty much aimed at getting something. Even the good acts, offering, praying, reciting something out loud, it was all like mixed up with selfishness. You don't engage in any relationship at all without getting something out of it, and you realize that. It's very cold, it's very sad, and you realize that. As you come down out of it, you realize that you have seen the Buddha directly. Which part of the Buddha? His essence, okay? You see that. You know you have seen the Buddha directly.
What do you mean by essence?
His emptiness. Which is his main body. If you ever have to meet the Buddha, that's the only... Then you can say you've met the Buddha directly. And you know that when you come out of it. That you have met the Buddha directly. Your future Buddha. You know how many lives it will take. Seven is very, very typical. So that when you become a Buddha, they will not refer to you with your name. They won't call you mind. And I don't mean that just because you've changed into some other person or something like that. There's a meaning to the process of names. You won't be called by a name like that anymore. Anyone in the world. You get a very clear, strong experience of bodhicitta. And it expresses itself as a physical sensation. And you see or you feel a kind of energy or light coming out of your heart and going out to all beings in the world. And you understand that for the rest of your life you will dedicate it to the good of other people.
It's just physical?
I mean, you understand that, but you also get this very specific physical sensation of light coming out of your heart and going out to other people, all other beings. The rest of your activity in your life to helping other people. You know it, and it happens to you. You understand directly the need to prostrate, and when you get up out of your meditation position, you get down on your face. And you throw yourself down in your face. Because you understand, prostration is really that. If you ever met, if Jesus walked in this room and you really understood who he was and you really knew who he was, you would throw yourself flat on the ground. And you wouldn't get up until he pulled you off the ground.
Okay.
If you really understood that object, if you really met the Buddha, you would throw yourself on the ground and you would be down flat on the ground. Out of awe, and it happens to you. You must do it, and you will do it. And you just get down on your face in front of that object. You understand prostration. An offering. You make for the first time in your life a real offering, which is not mixed up in any way with self-interest. You don't care if anyone ever knows that you made it. You spend every last cent you have to make it. You don't care if anyone ever sees you make it or understands that you made it, and you offer a diamond.
Diamond?
The diamond is you understand at that moment the meaning of a diamond. It's a really very direct and important relationship between the metaphor of a diamond, right? The insufficient metaphor of a diamond and what you saw. It's the only thing that comes anywhere near. You understand images of the Buddha, which means you gain a new understanding of what a tanka means, okay? What a picture of the Buddha means. You met the Buddha. And it occurs to you at that moment that someone saw Tara, you know? Someone saw her. There's a message in this painting. There's something important there. Someone saw her. The first person who painted it. And then people since then maybe have copied it. But this is a lineage, okay? You realize that a painting is a lineage going back to the first person who saw her. Somebody saw her, somebody painted what she looked like. If the artists haven't messed up since then, which Buddhist artists, Tibetan Buddhist artists, are not allowed to do, they're not allowed to change a single detail of a Buddha's image. And the image is laid out in the Abhisamangkara. There's certain dimensions, there's certain proportions. A Tibetan Buddhist painter is not allowed to change them, ever. Because someone saw her, and that's what she really looks like. And you gain a new respect for tankas. Tankas are not just the artwork anymore. They represent the truth that someone had direct contact with Tara, and that's the evidence of it. And that's what paintings mean to you after that. Religion, okay? Not a popular term. If you're a liberal and modern person, you're not supposed to say that, okay? You then understand that all the books of Buddhism are totally correct. It's all for real. There really is a Buddha. There really is an enlightenment. There really is a way to get to that enlightenment. Emptiness is really true. If you perceive emptiness directly, you will become enlightened. You perceive all those things directly. There's no question anymore. No one could ever say anything to you again that would make you doubt it. You saw it directly. It is the true image. I won't say that in Central Park to 1,000 people, okay? But between friends, it's true. And those books are perfectly true. All of those books are perfectly true. You must preserve those books. And it's like the paintings. You must not screw around with them, okay? They contain the information that people need to reach enlightenment and escape suffering. And they are perfectly correct. In their original form. You must not change them, you must not mess around with them, you must not interpret them, you must not try to update them for the modern world. They are pure and perfectly correct. And they work. And you see that. Last thing.
Thank heavens.
Not a joke, okay? Number F, okay? Not a joke. One of the side perceptions you have while you're perceiving the Four Noble Truths directly, Arya Truths, is that you understand that you're not crazy. You understand that you're having tema. Okay? You understand that you are correctly perceiving reality and that this is all true. What happened to you is absolutely true, and all the realizations you're having for that day are absolutely true. And that's just the side confirmation. You know everything that's going on that day is totally true. You have a perception of its truth. If you didn't, then all other things would be questionable, right? But you have a perception that it's true, that you're not crazy. Say, this is the true meaning of like an illusion. You never know it until this time. What it means is when you come out of that experience, something reasserts itself. What? Something that was missing for the first time comes back.
Conventional perceptions.
Your perception of things as self-existent. It comes back again. Okay? It takes hold of you again. As soon as you start perceiving anything except emptiness, it comes back. But there's a big difference now. What? You know you're screwed up. You know you're seeing things wrong. You're sure of it. Can you stop it?
No.
You cannot. You cannot. So it's a very weird state of life. Okay? You know you're wrong, but you can't stop it. That's what the meaning of illusion is in Buddhism. It has no other meaning. has no other meaning. None of those nice, sexy meanings that you read in the books.
Okay.
The only meaning. That's exactly what it means. The state of life after that, until you get rid of that tendency, is called jumata. Life is like an illusion up to this. And you know it. You perceive it as an illusion.
Did you say after that or before that?
After the last second of the direct perception of emptiness, up to the time you reach nirvana or Buddhahood, all that period is jumata. So there's... People ask me, you know, do Aryas suffer anymore? Do Aryas have bad thoughts anymore? What do you think?
Yeah.
They have both, okay? There's only two bad thoughts you lose forever when you see emptiness directly. What do you guess?
Wrong with you?
One is a belief in self-existence, okay? An intellectual belief in self-existence. Okay? People can ask you forever after that, are you perceiving the world correctly? And you will say, no, I'm not. But at least I know it. Okay? So intellectually, you can never again believe that you are seeing things what? Correctly. You know your mind is defective. Okay? You know that your perceptions are defective. No one can ever convince you again. You lost your intellectual belief that you are seeing everything correctly. Okay, what's the second thing you lose forever?
Doubt.
Okay, doubt in the past. You've seen a Buddha directly. You've seen your future enlightenment directly. You've seen that all the books of Buddhism are totally correct. So, who's going to convince you? By the way, you also see that your future seven lives are going to be quite pleasant. It doesn't mean that you might not have a horrible accident, because you still have karma. But what it means is, generally speaking, those next seven lives will be spent in perfect conditions. You will be exposed to Dharma. You will never be hungry. You'll never have want of a job. You'll always have a nice income. You'll be born into a good family. You will be the cream of the people on the planet at that time. You know, the way we are in this room. We are the top 1,000 of humanity. We have money, we have food, we have place to stay, we have Dharma. We are the cream, the cream. We are one in a million, literally. And you will be that for the other seven lives that you still have to stay there. And that's something to look forward to. That's another reason to do those three prerequisites. Okay? And I swear, you can get to that. And then you will... What do you care then, after that? What do you care about it? You know what's going to happen. And you know how it's going to be. Be careful. Sure you want to ask the question? Okay, go ahead. I won't yell at you. I'm sorry.
You don't have to call.
Literally, Ken. Go ahead.
After the path you die, you go to your next life. Do you remember that?
Not as a child, not directly. Bhaktak said, at a certain age, maybe 16, 17, the Bhaktak will assert itself, and you'll know everything.
You'll perceive it again directly, and then
you do perceive emptiness directly again during that period. Okay. That period is called the path of what? What's the fourth path?
Initiation.
What's your job on the fourth path? No, it's to use your understanding of emptiness. It's to use it to do what? Two things, basically.
Do only virtue and purify negative.
You remove your mental afflictions. To get rid of the rest of the 83,998 mental afflictions. Okay? You use your understanding of emptiness on a day-to-day basis to get rid of your bad emotions. And that's the only way you can get rid of your bad emotions. Because the definition of nirvana is what? Nindya malukapame soso tango. Based on your understanding of the Four Noble Truths, those things I just listed, you start to overcome your bad emotions forever. The day that you do, you reach nirvana. Without that ammunition of seeing emptiness directly, you never will. You cannot. It's impossible. What's the second thing you get rid of? What's the second job on the path of habituation? By the way, habituation means getting used to what you saw, right? For a whole lifetime. The path of habituation goes on for the rest of your life until you achieve nirvana or Buddha. Or the next seven lives.
With continuous perception of emptiness, or not necessarily another one in that whole life?
Not necessarily.
And why?
That's why it's called habituation. Getting used to what you saw, putting it into your everyday life.
Continue going to.
Right. What's the second job of the prophet? What else do you need to reach Buddhahood? To get rid of your bad thoughts, you reach nirvana, but not Buddhahood. What do you need to become a Buddha?
Omniscience.
Okay? There are certain obstacles to omniscience, and you have to overcome them. All of this is predicated on losing a certain tendency that reasserted it at the beginning of the path of habituation, which was what?
Seeing
things as self-existent. So what the big time, the final stages of the path of habituation are when you lose your tendency to see things as self-existent. The inborn tendency, the innate tendency, the tendency which amoebas and bugs and worms and elephants and Einstein have. Okay. When you lose that, you're a Buddha. That's how you get to be a Buddha. That's all. So the purpose of coming to this class, most of us, I think, it's kind of like an experience of collecting some knowledge or becoming more knowledgeable or feeling like we're doing something about our lives. But there you have it. That's all of Buddhism. That's the whole process to becoming enlightened. You have to work on it. Initially, you have to overcome those three, you have to get over those three mountains. You must leave this world. You must develop the ability to meditate deeply, or you never will see emptiness directly. And thirdly, you must mull over the meaning of, you must try to come to see how you're not perceiving anything that you thought you were. You're only seeing your mental picture of it. You have to contemplate that. Then you can reach it. Otherwise, no. We'll never. If you want to disqualify yourself from this race, ignore one of those three. All right. Thanks. I'm sorry I got a little angry. We'll do a prayer and then I'll hand out.